Thank you for joining us and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. Now, for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain, while bringing on answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. Now, I'd really appreciate if you could all do me a big favor. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. This is one powerful way that together we can make a positive influence in the world. Now, I also want you to know that this show, we're going to introduce talented authors, new innovations in the areas of health, happiness, and security, which is just another way to create more joy for you and your family. Now I'm going to start with a quote, and this quote was, "The volcano of ill health has erupted." Now this was a statement made to the European Economic Health Conference in the spring of 2018 by the noted cardiologist from London, Asim Mahatra, MD. Now, drawing from more than 45 years of practicing Eastern medicine, our guest today, Michael J. Shea, PhD, presents a holistic guide to biodynamic manual therapy practices for optimizing the immune system and for healing the deep spiritual suffering of our contemporary world. Michael holds a doctorate in somatic psychology from Union Institute and has taught at the Upledger Institute, the Santa Barbara Graduate Institute, and the International University for Professional Studies. He is a founding board member of the Biodynamic Craniosacral Therapy Association of North America and the International Affiliation of Biodynamic Trainings. He is the author of several books, including his newest book, The Biodynamics of the Immune System, Balancing the Energies of the Body with the Cosmos. Michael, welcome to Answers Network.
Good morning, Alan, and thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to talk about our mutual work, actually.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm so impressed with reading the book and the focus that keeps bringing back to it's in our body.
Yeah.
It's in us. It's not out there. It's in us. If we can just master it, if we can just really focus on that. And one of the things that I was thinking about as I was reading the book was how much it seems like it's needed now more than ever. But I know how long it takes to write a book. So my guess is that you may have started this some time ago. Why did you make the decision to write this book and why now?
Well, you know, I've been working on this book, Alan, for probably about 10 years. And if you read some of the parts in the first section there, you know, when I left military service, I was morbidly obese. And I was very fortunate to run into some naturopaths in New York City. We're talking about the early 70s. It really turned my life around. And so since that time, I've really been, you know, focusing and practicing what does it take to feel safe in my body? And what does it take to trust my body? And that's a wide variety, you know, including exercise and so forth, but also diet. And we see the continual ongoing degradation of the human body. You know, that book I wrote because of I see clients, and I write these books because of what I see happening with the contemporary client. And in the last 3 years, we've seen the degradation of the immune system. And that's a major problem. And it can be fixed. It can be fixed.
You know, and I know in the book you talk about your own journey, which I think is great. When you look at all of us, you know, as a race, I mean, how ill are we, you know, as part of the people of this planet, as human beings?
Well, I would say, you know, two things with that. And the first thing is that metabolically, and that's one of the points with the book, metabolically, we're very, very sick. Americans especially are very, very sick. A study in 2018, actually, from the University of North Carolina stated that 88% of Americans are metabolically unhealthy. And it hasn't gotten any better because last year, a very prestigious cardiology journal said that 93% of Americans are heart unhealthy, metabolically unhealthy hearts. That's awful that our country is like that. And we see that spill out into dialogue, into polarization, into the excessive emotions and rage that's out there. And I see that as all linked together. And on the other hand, I also see that the last 3 years has given us an opportunity for spiritual growth. If you want to get away from the rage and the anger and begin trusting your body, then you can come into a more spiritually grounded place.
You know, I'm so glad you brought up the part about the 93%. Yesterday I was doing some of my studying to get ready for this show, and I came across that same figure, and it absolutely blew me away. And I do some of my studying in the gym. So here I am, I'm in the gym and I'm exercising and I'm amongst people. And I'm like, how can it be 93%? It's so incredible to me that we can have that percentage of people who are either unhealthy, either their heart or their metabolic system. And yet we're not focusing on the right things.
Well, I completely agree, you know, but, you know, if we could turn off some of the television, you know, my wife and I finally had to turn off the television and reduce the amount of social media, you know, reduce the amount of screen time. But these are things we've already, you know, always heard about. And basically, in biodynamic work, you know, the cranial sacral or the manual therapeutic arts in general is just what I'm doing now is applying them to the cardiovascular system. And because that is the system that runs the entire homeostatic processes of the human body. But we have to have a good intestinal lining, and therein lies the problem. 80% of our immune system lines, our innate immune system lines the gut. And because we have an addiction to processed food, and you can go online and you can see 10 or 20 research articles on how much processed food Americans are eating. Like 70% of the food that Americans eat is processed. And that is what's causing a breakdown in the gut. That breakdown in the gut goes right to the vascular system. That's the next layer. And it goes to the liver, and then it spreads throughout the body. And depending on your genetics, it's not going to affect everything, but it will manifest differently. And it'll incubate different metabolic problems over time, especially, you know, like type 2 diabetes and things like that. Obesity, we have a major problem in our country with that. These are all metabolic problems. And if we have metabolically unhealthy hearts, we see that, though, in the toxicity of the dialogue that happens frequently, you know, in our culture, not just America, but worldwide. And we see that level of, I call it cardiotoxicity. You know, the excessive anger and the excessive pushback. And so really finding that a middle ground with that as much as possible. But, you know, metabolically, it's got to start with the diet and de-stressing ourselves.
Well, I couldn't agree more. You know, share with us some of the other diseases or the other things that are coming out, because, you know, I talk with people and they're constantly now saying, you know, that, you know, there's greater dementia, there's greater Parkinson's, there's, you know, there's more and more of these diseases coming out, and yet nobody really wants to look at why. So are these things also tied to what you're talking about? And are we going to be able to reduce these types of things as well, just by doing, as you say, in regards to reducing our stress and focusing more on keeping a healthy immune system?
Alan, everything you mentioned is a metabolic problem. Dementia is a metabolic problem. I was just reading some research on that yesterday. And when you have a vascular system in the brain that has very tight junctions, it's very tight, tighter than anywhere else in the body. Remember that if you're eating let's say junk food, processed food, all of this gives off waste products. We're not just talking about perspiration and bowel movements and urination, but we're talking about cellular metabolism. And basically, when that waste product's coming from individual cells in the brain can't get out, it gets backed up. And so you have these things called brain fog, and it you can in some people begin to reduce dementia. And again, it's going to be not only a stress dynamic, but it's going to be also a dietary dynamic, a nutritional. We're starving. We're starving as a culture, you know, with this food we're eating. The person I follow out in Northern California is Robert Lustig, MD. He's a pediatric neuroendocrinologist. And I've been following him forever, along with Asim Malhotra, who you mentioned at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And basically, Lustig's message, which I bring it loud and clear in my book, it's not only about processed food, but that processed food is breaking down into sugar, because those processed food items are carbohydrates. We got way too much sugar going on. And then the added sugar issue. Lustig's an expert on the sugar issue, and well worth tuning into, you know, in terms of social media. And he's one of the people that I follow, that I mention in the book, you know, that feeds me this information, that tells me exactly the problem I had. I was addicted to sugar. I told my wife yesterday, when I finally broke that habit to sugar, how emotionally painful it was to pass up a bakery that had all these sugar-laden glazed donuts and things. But this is an addiction, and this is what he's pointing out. And so we have a problem that way regarding diet and nutrition, and we're not getting any help from the USDA, because they're still promoting a high-carb, low-fat diet. And that's basically what's gotten us into trouble in the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that the term you use is that, you know, we're starving ourselves, we're starving our bodies of what it is that they need. And yet at any moment, we can get in the car and drive down the street. And if we drive more than a couple of miles, we'll drive past 10, 15 different types of restaurants or fast food places that are promoting, you know, their products, and that we're bombarded with that. How do we turn this around?
Well, what I say in my book is, Alan, the kitchen is the new ER. You know, if you have metabolic syndrome, I also work with death and dying. My wife and I, my wife is a minister, and we do work with death and dying. It's not pretty when you have metabolic syndrome and you end up in intensive care unit. It's multiple organ failure. And so this is very, very important to remember, you know, that we have to be able to take care of our organ systems that way. But again, getting back to the dietary component, I want to just keep going back to that, because of the way in which the processed food breaks down and degrades the epithelial lining of the gut. And that's called leaky gut. You can go online and look at a lot of that. We have a lot of repair work to do, Alan. There's a lot of repair work. It's not just about Lustig's dynamic is real food. I love that. It's so clear and it's so simple. Real food, okay? You know, farm to table, you know, get out in the backyard. We're getting as sustainable as possible here in our tropical environment, and we grow a lot of our own food. The food I ate this morning came from my own yard. And yes, it's labor intensive, and it's time consuming. And a lot of Americans, I think upwards of 20 or 25%, get all of their meals through a fast food line at a restaurant. 33% of Americans do not know how to cook. That's a major time commitment. So it's eating right and it's real food, but then you have to consider, and I've mentioned this, I go over this really well in my book, the dynamics of managing a kitchen, you know, the prep time, the cleanup time, how to read a label. We're starting over again from scratch, Alan. We're babies in this new world. If we want to be reborn, you know, with a healthy immune system, and we can do it. Dr. Jason Fung, world's leading authority on obesity, is a nephrologist in Toronto. He's able to reverse type 2 diabetes in some patients in 14 days with real food. So It'll be harder for some people because of their epigenetics, and it could be easier for other people. I was fortunate. I did water fasting, and I studied naturopathy with Ann Wigamore of the Hippocrates Health Institute in Boston. This is back in the 70s. So I learned old-style European naturopathy, and I learned how to fast, and I did a lot of fasting. But people are so sick nowadays, you can't put them on a water fast. You have to. It has to be a very slow process. So there's a lot of help out there. That's what I want to say. There's a lot of help out there. We're talking principles right now, but there's a lot of help in going through these steps.
You know, it's interesting that you brought up fasting, and there are so many different groups that are almost militant to the point of promoting whatever it is that they believe in. And so, you know, we have the guy out there that's known that, you know, he's the carnivore guy or whatever, you know, all you're supposed to eat is meat. You just have to eat meat. And if you eat any of this other stuff, it's terrible for you. And then you have vegans that, okay, you can only eat this. And they're militant about it. And you see them on the internet and they're attacking each other. And it's just frustrating to me that there's all these different things. And I think that some of the things they're missing, and my question is going to be asking you is what are some of the things they're missing? But some of the things are, one is we're different. We're all not exactly the same. And then the other part is that has to do with when you brought up fasting, as far as they don't seem to have as much communication about when you eat. And I know that I've gotten into a point now to where I have a time restricted periods of time in which I will eat. And it has helped so much. But I also don't go and try and tell everybody to do it because I realize they're different. So what are your thoughts on this area?
Well, first of all, regarding diets, and I've tried a lot of different diets, you know, since I got out of the military in 1973. And my realization now at the age of 74 is it's trial and error. There's no one size fits all. You know, you try something, and if it doesn't work, then you move on to the next possibility. And there are ways to work with that. They're really good teachers. My sister, Sheila Shea, runs the Intestinal Health Institute, and she's a GAPS certified nutritional coach, the gut and psychology syndrome diet. So it's very much about try this. Oh, that doesn't work. Try this. So it requires some nutritional coaching as you go along, and it is trial and error because in my 30s, my metabolic demands were different. In my 40s, they were different. So there's a developmental phase that we also have to appreciate. You can't be eating the same thing you were eating in your 30s. I mean, I have my comfort food of bacon every now and then from childhood, but that's it. I'm not going to eat that every day. However, now the second part of your question was around fasting. Mm-hmm. And I look at the literature on that. I consider myself an expert because I did a 40-day water fast, a 60-day water fast. I've done multiple-day juice fasting. I tend to limit it now to 3 to 5 day periods of fasting. And I want to just tell the audience why that's important. And Alan, what you said around time-restricted eating is another way or another metaphor for describing intermittent fasting. Mm-hmm. For example, it's really, really valuable to manage at least 12 to 16 hours between the last thing you put in your mouth at night and the first thing you put in your mouth in the morning. Just 12 to 16 hours. If you're hypoglycemic, that's another issue, and it could be addressed by a nutritional coach. But if you can tolerate 12 to 16 hours, it allows the cellular metabolism that I mentioned a couple of minutes ago. It allows every cell in the body to process the waste products that all the energy that the mitochondria need in every cell that's coming from the food we're eating, because that's the prime directive. Feed the mitochondria. That's number one. Those waste products then have a chance to dissipate out of the system, and that's called autophagy. Autophagy. And so the longer you can go, it's so much better because your body does its natural housekeeping, and that's what intermittent fasting is about. It's about just giving your body the opportunity, and that's what the research says. take some time off from what the Japanese call lonely mouth disease. You know, you've got to keep putting stuff in your mouth, you know, the midnight snacking and all of that. And if there's anything that I've said in the last couple of minutes, it would be 12 to 16 hours is so nourishing and health restoring if that's all you do.
Now, I love that you brought up autophagy, but share a little bit more about that, because I think it's so important. And I know that when I learned about it, it was very enlightening. So explain a little bit more so that people understand that, as you said, if they keep feeding and you never get rid of this through autophagy, you never get rid of these cells, where do they go? They sit there, right?
They sit there. You know, just I don't want to oversimplify metabolism because it's exceedingly complex. But I was an academic embryologist, and in learning about embryology and metabolism, the setup is you build up the anabolism and you get the food you need. It breaks down however it breaks down. And like I said, the mitochondria, that's the prime directive. You have to have energy to run the body. So the food we eat, the air we breathe and so forth. And that gets broken down and gets given to the mitochondria, and that creates ATP. I mean, we know probably many of our listeners might know about that cycle. The point we're talking about are waste products. So it's not just about a healthy diet. It's the waste products, getting rid of the waste products. Now, when a cell, when the mitochondria, when they excrete waste products, it's into the cytoplasm. And so there is a vesicle that surrounds the waste product and actually secretes enzymes and acids that begins to eat and break down those waste products. Well, guess what? It breaks them down into smaller components until they can finally get out of wherever they are into the bloodstream and excrete it out through urine, feces, and so forth, and sweat. So it's elegantly simple if you give it time to work and not keep overloading it with these processed foods. My sister says you can do without carbohydrates. And I've seen the literature on that. And the literature on that is clear because the brain likes ketones more than it likes glucose. So your brain cells likes high quality protein and fat from meat. Okay. And less so from glucose. So that's, I know that's a controversy. We may see some pushback on that. But I also worked in the field, Alan, for 40 years in pediatrics. And so my other specialty is working with moderate to severely developmentally delayed children. That means brain-damaged infants and children. Mm-hmm. And since the 1920s, it's been known that the ketogenic diet is very curative and helpful to the brains of these children. And I've seen it for 40 years. But then when you suggest, oh, let's give adults with dementia, because that's a brain problem, let's give them a ketogenic diet. It's like, oh, no, we can't do that. It's like, I'm sorry, that's corporate pushback. That's not right. There's good, solid literature around this. I'm not saying the ketogenic diet is good for everybody. It's trial and error. Remember, it's trial and error. It might not work for you. It's about having a high quality source of protein and fat. And there are other high quality sources of protein and fat.
You know, I was recently having a conversation with someone in regards to, just as you were saying, the types of diets that we should have young children on. And to prove a point to them that we've been lied to, I went and I pulled some advertisements from the 50s and 60s. And one of them was, it was an advertisement by probably the biggest soda pop company in the world. And it was, and it had a picture of a baby and a mom. And it says, start them on this soda pop earlier, get them on this soda pop sooner. You know, in other words, put it in their bottle. You know, and this was allowed to go out, to women of the 50s and 60s that this is what you're supposed to do with your baby. And so when somebody tells me, well, this has to be good because doesn't the government look at these advertisements and that, you know, they say they can do this. And I go, so if you believe all of that, then you must believe this one also. And then I just want them to think, you know, that we're not always being told the truth. And like you said, it's there. Yes, there's trial and error. There's also common sense.
Common sense. And Alan, you know, I work with a number of midwives and I'm still work, you know, as a consult in the pediatric field. And when you see infant formulas that are full of sugar, you know, it's the same issue. And Dr. Thomas Rau, the Swiss biological medicine model that my wife talks about, because she's certified in that. And that's the clinic I teach at in Switzerland, is the Swiss biological medicine clinic, Dr. Thomas Rau. He says, when you give these infants sugar in their formula, the medical system creates a client for life. It's a client for life because it degrades the immune system, the developing immune system. Instead of having, you know, the breast milk with the healthy immune factors in it to build the system and all that. And I know there's complications around all of this. I mean, I've been in the field and I see what parents and especially parents with newborn babies deal with. So I'm not saying this is easy, but it does require some work and support, social and community support. But it's back to Lustig. You got to stop the sugar. That's the first step. You got to stop added sugar. It's killing us.
Well, you got that right. All right. We are talking with Dr. Michael Shea, and we are talking about our immune system. We're going to take a break. But when we come back, Michael, what I'd like you to talk a little bit about is how is the body made up of the five elements in Eastern tradition? I know you talk about it in your book. And how do these elements offer a method for us to reclaim the body? So for everybody, stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to or watching Answers Network.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services and West Shield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. We are speaking with Michael J. Shea, PhD. We're talking about his latest book, The Biodynamics of the Immune System, Balancing the Energies of the Body with the Cosmos. So, Michael, when we went to break, I asked you a little bit about the five elements of Eastern traditions. What can you share with us about that?
Well, that's a major section of my book. It has to do with healing ceremonies. I was a student of medical anthropology, and, you know, in the early animistic and shamanistic cultures, you know, healing rituals and healing ceremonies were very important in order to heal a person who was stricken with a disorder or a disease in that particular culture. And the ceremonies were designed about regressing the patient back to the time of their embryonic period, when they were perfectly whole at the beginning of time, when the supernatural deities and so forth created, you know, a single-celled human being that was perfectly whole at the time. But the other ceremony was also about cosmology. If you couldn't heal someone by regressing them back to their embryonic period, then you had to regress them back to the beginning of the universe, okay? So that's just the theory. We could talk about that ad infinitum, but that's the theory. And what was at the beginning of the universe, according to Eastern traditions, and what was at the beginning of our embryonic period? Well, it started with five elements. So that's the way those cosmologies discuss how the universe was created and what it consists of, and also the human embryo. So there's two types of Eastern traditions regarding that. I've been a student of Tibetan medicine for over 40 years. I'm not a Tibetan physician, but I still study with the teachers at Pure Land Farms in Los Angeles. Dr. Nita is probably one of the leading experts in the United States, and he's a Tibetan physician and a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner. So in the issue of the five elements really has to do with the five senses. I mean, I could, again, we could get off in talking about the five elements from the Indo-Tibetan point of view, which is really what I know more about. And then there's the other system of five elements, the Sino-Tibetan tradition, which is really physiologically oriented. But that's another story. But if we talk about the five elements, it means that how do we come into relationship with our five senses? Because each element is associated with one of the senses. So how do we come into relationship with our vision? How do we come into relationship with color? How do we come into relationship with our breath? How do we become aware of the wind and the air moving in us? And it's simple awareness. How do we become aware of just our heat and the warmth and the potency of our heart? The one of the fulcrums for the fire element is the heart. I love that. That's my work. So we have that fire element, the potency of the heart coming from there. And the water element is actually considered to be the blood, you know, that moving all through us and so forth. And then the earth element, you know, our connective tissue and our bones and so forth. So how do we come into relationship with our earthiness? And how do we come into relationship with flow? And a sense of flow in the body and a sense of spreading. And how do we come into a relationship with the heat in our body and so forth? How do we notice that? So all of that is about trusting our body, and it is the foundation for feeling safe, because all of these metabolic problems are creating a lack of safety where you don't have an inward sense of safety, and it's very difficult to trust your body because we're getting a lot of mixed signals in the culture. Mm-hmm. So the five elements are first and foremost about really feeling our body, becoming embodied and embodying our five senses. And that means without judgment, without interpretation. That's the hard piece right there at one level, because our mind gets very active. So we're constantly labeling everything we see. We're labeling, creating cognition, creating ideas, creating thoughts about what it is we're seeing, instead of just seeing color. Because in the Tibetan system of cosmology, what precedes the five elements are the five colors. So it's called wisdom eyes. You know, there's meditations to be able to just look at, you know, the world of nature. My YouTube channel has probably 30 or 40 visual meditations for looking at the horizon. I call it horizon therapy, where you can just tune into the subtle movement of the subtle wind, because all of these elements have gross factors that I just described, but they also have subtle elements. So elements relating to colors, relating to our senses, but it's really trusting the body and how well we can settle into our body and how well we can trust our mind, how well we can train our mind to slow down the thought process, to deconstruct some of the cognitions we have and drop into our body and create more balance. I'm not saying cognitions are wrong and that we, you know, we need to have less brain activity. I'm saying we're out of balance. And so right. In that context, that's what I'm referring to with the five elements. That's kind of a broad brushstroke there, but I hope it's helpful.
Well, it is helpful. And I realize that with us only having 50 minutes, we wouldn't be able to get into all of it anyway. But I think one of the things you touched on there that's really important is trust. And I know that for many of us, we think about the things that we did automatically because our body told us to. And I think we've gotten to this point to where, you know, we need to have, you know, if a doctor tells us, then they must know better. Or if a commercial tells us they must know better, that there's somehow been enough research done. And we're not really taking into consideration, I think, as a society, that those situations are set up for profit. And so, you know, go back to trusting your body, because I think so much of us really do know what's best for us, but we've decided we're going to allow somebody else to make those decisions for us. And we've turned some of those things off that we should have left on. Would you agree?
I completely agree with that, Alan. And it's very well said, that issue of trusting the body. We're bombarded by messages, subliminal messages all the time. And we know this from the marketing research, to not trust your body. You know, to trust this, trust the drug, trust the doctor. Not that you shouldn't trust those when you need them and when you're ill and you have a disease with which that might help. But when you're constantly being bombarded by those messages and the food messages, so all of that is just this bombardment to not trust the body. And consequently, that means, unconsciously, I'm not feeling safe. You know, we start eating that food or we're actually ingesting those messages. And the big thing here is just not feeling safe, you know, within that. You know, we don't feel safe with the environment. We don't feel emotionally safe. We don't feel metabolically or embodied safety. And then we've got the whole issue of trauma around that's lopped on top of that. And so that filter of trust and safety is so, I would say that's the key point right now, Alan. How do we do that? It's embracing the contemplative arts. My master's degree was in contemplative psychotherapy at Naropa Institute, or it's now Naropa University. And we see that, you know, in the meditation practices, it's just so valuable to have a way to deconstruct our mind, our thoughts, and our cognitions, and settle into our senses. We've got to have that way through whatever contemplative art form or whatever non-dual meditation practice that people might be doing. But that's what brings us back into balance, along with real food, real food.
Yeah. You know, there is an area that you touch on a little bit in the book, and I'm very curious. And again, for those out there, if you're watching or listening for the first time, my background comes from being an international detective. So I have to research it. I have to find the answers. I have to be able to grasp it. And the area of distance healing, I can't put my finger on it. I can't grasp it. I can't fully understand it, which doesn't mean that I discount it, but I really wish that I understood it better. And I think if more people that are watching or listening to this, if they understood it better, that may also be helpful too. So can you explain distance healing in a manner that many of us can understand?
Well, Alan, I'll give it my best shot. I think, you know, because that's a really good question. I get it a lot, you know, within the manual therapy community, especially cranial community. So now there's two camps. Yes, you can do distance healing. No, you can't. You got to keep your hands on. Let me just mention, back when I did my doctoral work in the 90s, the very first study that came out about this was called the BIRD study, BYRD. So if you Google BIRD study, you'll see that there was a cardiologist in San Francisco, and he took a cohort of his cardiology patients, and half of the cohort just got standard cardiac medical care. And the other half of the cohort, and I forget the numbers because this is years ago, but the other half of the cohort, they were farmed out with their names and photographs to various religious groups throughout the United States and that specifically were prayed over at a particular point in time. And of course, you know that there's a happy ending to this story, because at the end of the research, all the people in the cohort that got prayed over distance-wise got better, okay? Mm-hmm. And then that got me into the spirituality and health research. Now, at the time in the 90s, I could only find less than 100 research articles on spirituality and health, less than 100. Wow. Now there's countless thousands. But the synopsis at that time in the 90s was that going to church, and I would like to say now, having a spiritual practice is so incredibly important for your well-being. and for your health, not only metabolically, but spiritually, because come on, it's all one thing. So it's really challenging. And I can give you a practical piece on this, because I was doing Rolfing work for many years. In 1979, I went to the Rolf Institute, and I opened my first Rolfing practice in Boulder, Colorado. And I lived about four blocks from my office. And so it was a great walk back and forth. And every morning on the way to work, and I'd had my four or five clients, my body would start aching, like the low back would start to ache, and that would go away for a couple of minutes. And then all of a sudden my neck would ache, or there'd be another orthopedic thing. Each of the clients, somehow or another, and I've heard this from many therapists, each of the clients I was connected with. And so we can talk about distance healing, but we can also talk about being a healer. And, yeah, and that is that I can feel, you know, the pain and suffering of other people. That's not just a healer. That's called emotional empathy. That's called somatic empathy. That's well-researched. We know that. We can feel when we read about some tragedy that happens halfway around the globe, we can feel that. What's the difference between that and praying for someone around the globe? And I think the issue around that, because especially around tragedy, is there's so much fear around that. And so really people feel afraid for themselves first when there's a tragedy, but then overcoming that fear, because that's the global condition. When you want to pray for somebody else with cancer, I've got a lot of people on my prayer list right now that are really desperately ill, and they get prayed for every day. What does that mean? That means I think about them. I don't have a specific prayer. I don't have a liturgy or a sadhana or whatever. I think about them, and I feel an empathetic process going on. I feel my heart, and I feel the warmth of my heart. So it's as easy as that, Alan. It's as easy as thinking about someone. And from there are organizations that teach distance healing and different styles of distance healing, from shamanic styles to more contemporary styles, to more Western styles, and so forth. Was that helpful?
Yes. Yeah, it is. It's, I've had prayer as a part of my life, you know, since I was, grade school. So I can see that part of it, but when the one-on-one, you know, the distance healer that that is able to channel everything that they're doing into one person at that moment and focus on that one person and know what's going on in them and know that they're dealing with a particular illness or a particular virus is now in them, you know, these type of things, this ability to be able to do it from a distance, you know, just it's not something I've been able to completely understand. And again, it doesn't mean that I discount it. It's just, it's frustrating. The detective in me, it's like, I need to know how are you doing this?
Right. Well, if you need to know how, there's certain systems. One of the more popular systems now is esoteric healing. That's readily available in the United States, and that's a very valuable dynamic there. I think that's very important. There was something you said that I was going to respond to, and it slipped my mind. But the esoteric healing. Oh, I know what I wanted to say,
yeah.
Alan. The way I teach is that each of us has a gift. Mm-hmm. And I don't have the gift of thinking about someone lying on their bed, dying of cancer. I don't have the gift of them coming in and seeing that they have a problem with their kidney. That's not my gift. And so I've come to realize, you know, because I have about 500 students a year, you know, and so it's really amazing. And what I try to do is I try to promote, what is your gift? What is, you know, the gift that I have, that you have, Alan, and that some I've come to accept in terms of acceptance therapy. I've come to accept that there are those that have a gift that can see certain things in the body and can channel certain, if you want to call it, energy to that person. whether or not, you know, that's placebo effect or not, if they feel better and if it helps them, and if it's like holding their hand, you know, through a difficult time, then that's fine. I support that gift, and I really want to help people with that gift. And I can't explain it because I can't do it like yourself.
Yeah, and I almost feel bad that I'm now spending so much time on something that I'm so interested in. But at the same time, we've got some listener questions in, and I just looked up, we've only got about 4 minutes. But one of these reads, it says, I've been researching everything I can about the immune system and its relationship to inflammation. As I have aged, the arthritic changes in my body are a great concern, especially since my mother was crippled with rheumatoid arthritis in her 70s. I read in the summary that your book shows how inflamed components of the food in our body, such as blood and lymphatic system, form the substrate of metabolic syndromes. How does that apply to arthritic inflammation? And this is from Henrietta in Utah.
Well, the simplest way to address that in a short period of time is just, you know, in reviewing what we've said, is that the innate immune system that's lining the gut, when it's been challenged with these processed foods, it breaks down. And so the first thing the immune system does is it creates inflammation in order to alert the entire immune system through the body that there's a problem. And unfortunately, the immune system then will create a cytokine storm and ratchet up more inflammation for the body to naturally, you know, fight these dynamics. I'm not saying that this is a dietary issue with the questioner, because, again, it's a medical question. I'm not a medical doctor, but I can say that it's very important that there be some repair of the gut, that there be some experimenting with real food, and also detoxification. If the kitchen's the new ER, I'm saying that the bathroom is the new intensive care unit. It's the new ICU. And I recommend enemas, and I also recommend colon hydrotherapy. This is my wife's specialty. She's trained medical teams and clinics internationally to bring this colon hydrotherapy into the general medical milieu. So detoxification is very important. It's exceedingly important, not only the proper food, but also the detox.
All right. We've got another one. We've only got about 2 minutes. This one says, a YouTube video I watched recently showed how putting cold compresses on the vagus nerve could positively affect inflammation. I hope I'm describing this properly, as what I understood is that the vagus nerve connects our brain's transmission of messages directly to the immune system, thereby affecting inflammation responses, suggesting that by cooling the nerve, it may have a positive effect on infections, sepsis, and autoimmune diseases. Do you agree with this? And are they referring to viral infections? What other comments do you have on this? And this is from Aaron in Maine.
Aaron, I have a major part of my book on the vagus nerve. So what you called a cold compress, that's called a vagal maneuver. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of new literature out right now, and it's been out there for about 5 years, on VNA, vagal nerve VNS, vagal nerve stimulation. And so that's a way to stimulate the vagus nerve. There's many other ways to stimulate the vagus nerve, and that stimulation creates an anti-inflammatory effect. So here we are. The body knows how to heal itself. It's got an inflammation. Mm-hmm. So if you stimulate the vagus nerve through breathing techniques, yoga, exercise, cold compresses on the face, or there's medical devices now. There's all sorts of medical devices, right. Really expensive ones too. You can then stimulate the vagus nerve. It'll create an anti-inflammatory effect, but don't rely on that as the only way to fight inflammation.
Michael, thank you so much. I wish we had more time. Would I be correct that the book is available anywhere you can find books, such as Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and whatever?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Okay. And for everybody out there, and if you are going to order the book, you can do so also, you know, through your local bookstore. I mean, if you can help give them business and do that, please do that as well. It's a great book. And again, if you can if you can do things to help your own immune system, it's going to keep you out of these other systems that are profiting greatly from our illness. So please do everything you can. And I just want to add also, because Michael and I were talking ahead of time, his next book is called The Body Dynamic Heart. So Michael, I would hope that as soon as that one's ready to go, that you can come back and we can talk about that as well.
Anytime, Alan. Thank you so much.
All right. And again, thank you so much. And you're making a great difference in the world, and I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
All right. For everybody out there, be with us next week. We're going to be joined by Bob Rosenborough to discuss his new book, A Place of Thin Veil, Life and Death in Gallup, New Mexico. And please, everybody, visit our archives of past interviews at anthers.network, or you can just subscribe to the show and they'll send them to you automatically through Apple Podcast, iHeartRadio, Spotify, SoundCloud, YouTube, Rumble, Spreaker, and so many more popular podcasts platforms. And if you like what you hear, please leave a review. I want you to know that we greatly appreciate it, and it helps other people find things that are going to help them. So you're making a positive difference just by helping people know where to find the right things. The next time you're on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, please stop by our page, check out our latest post, and if you like them, please like us and spread the word. For everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.